Hi, and welcome to the our podcast for the week, Nucleus Wealth Investment Insights. Just a quick reminder for everyone that what we've got, what you're hearing today is general advice. If you're looking for specific advice, you can jump onto our website and book yourself a meeting. But you know, everything we're talking about today is sort of more general and provided as provided very much for people just to have a try that again. I need to read through my disclaimer. It's all provided as it hasn't been taken into account your personal objectives, and you need to consider the appropriateness for yourself. What I really wanted to do today was have a look at the market and have a look at the sort of more broadly, where are we starting from? So we're into 2024, and pretty key to working out what's going to happen in terms of forecasts. So what's going to happen to stock markets is working out where are you, what are valuations doing, what's happening to earnings growth, what worked last year, and so what are some of the factors that we might want to be sort of leaning away from or leaning into 2024. I'll start on the valuation front. Valuations look expensive. Pretty much doesn't matter how you cut it, you sort of end up with some similar numbers. I'm using the 12-month forward price to earnings ratio, so it is looking at forecasts. If you look at historicals, you end up looking even more expensive. If you go a little bit further forward, if you look at sort of second year forecasts, it does look a little bit better. Not quite as expensive, but still relatively expensive. My preferred way is to sort of cut out financials and resources. Financials, because there are some differences in terms of the way they report and in terms of what we're in terms of how they affect some of these numbers, but resources in particular I like to cut out, because I do think you get a better feel over time for how expensive the market is. What you often find with the resources is they will be cheap when commodity prices are really high, and so you actually they're actually giving you a bit of a reverse indicator. So, for example, when the oil price hits $120, and these guys are raking in the money, what will often happen is their price to earnings ratios will be really low. So they might only be, say, five times earnings or something like that. And so you notionally they look really cheap, and it's because the earnings are at $120 oil, no one's expecting those earnings to keep going. And so then vice versa, when the earnings, when the oil price is at $20 and these companies are all loss making or making no profit, there's the expectation actually they are somewhat cheap at that point, even though that they that point. So anyway, when we look through those numbers, basically, if you look over the last 25 years, you've been more expensive effectively twice. Once during the tech boom, sort of back in around 2000, and once as we came out of that pandemic, and you really saw that growth sort of kick off into 2020 and 2021. So we're back to this sort of, pretty close to 20 times earnings on a global basis. If you look at the US, it's even more expensive. If you jump into looking at Australia, what you find with Australia is it's also sort of pretty similar levels to what you're seeing versus international. I think the key for me is looking at some relative ratios. So again, I do have the Australia versus world on the left, just for interest. But because Australia is so dominated by banks and resources, it is much better to look at Australia as three different categories. One is X banks and resources, and that we're actually looking back to sort of our average value. So over the last couple of years, Australia's looked quite expensive relative to the rest of the world, but that's coming back. And so, I think from Aussie equities versus international equities, there's no longer as much of a wow, they look really expensive relative to the rest of the world. If you look, and that's X banks and resources. If you look at the banks, they're still expensive relative to the rest of the world. They're 1.7 times the rest of the world, usually trading about 1.2 times. So a little bit of a mixture of Australian banks being a bit more expensive, and also a factor that a lot of the international banks really came back in price. Say the US, some of the US regionals and things like that fell, and Europe looks cheap. You know, we can go through different arguments on that, and we have in the past, and will again, I'm sure, in terms of looking and saying, well, you know, maybe the Aussie banks are, well, sorry, actually, let me take one step back. If you look at banks and how over the last few years we've been in this real low interest rate environment, and as part of being in this low interest rate environment, what we've seen is that the central banks are trying to stimulate the economies to get them going, and what's been happening is they've actually been subsidizing the banks. So we went through in Australia, we saw the really low interest rates, the 3-year really low interest rates that got offered to Aussie banks, and then they got to pass it on to the customers. And effectively, that's a bit of a free kick for the Aussie banks in terms of they've got this extra cheap funding. Now that went on for years in Europe. So Europe was actually even paying their banks over there to so you had sort of interest rates at pretty close to zero, and so they're actually paying a negative interest rate. So they're actually paying the banks to go out and lend to home loans. And then the other thing is the Aussie banks have got, well, certainly the big four have got this implicit guarantee that sort of hasn't been priced into has effectively been the market's treating them as if they have a government guarantee, which is effectively what's there. And so the question is, really, I guess when you come back to that, I know it's a bit of a long story, but maybe the Aussie banks are some of the most expensive in the world because they do generate some of the highest returns in the world, which is true. But that may well be because they're closer to the regulators than the rest of the world. So yeah, if that's the case, then the Aussie banks really comes down to saying, well, are we going to keep giving them handouts? So these governments going to keep giving them handouts? Are they going to stay really close to the regulators, and the regulators going to keep going to take it easy on them in terms of how that's going to affect the pricing? And then finally, then there's the Aussie resources versus world resources. And as I said, it's roughly within its normal range. Having said that, I don't think this is a particularly useful way to look at it. So that's where we're starting from in terms of valuations, is that the Aussie banks certainly at the upper end, the Aussie stock market about average relative to the rest of the world. The world itself are pretty expensive relative to where we've seen in the past. A couple of other things just to sort of keep in mind. I just have the Fed balance sheet. Now this is similar on a lot of other balance sheets, but there's a liquidity argument. Is what are governments doing? Are they pumping money into the market? Are they pulling money out of the market? They have a lot of assets. They're still like we're in the four trillions. It's certainly come back from where it was year and a half ago. But it's still much, much higher than what it was pre-pandemic. So and that's sort of similar or pretty similar. If you look at Europe and Japan as well. If you look at bond yields, so this is there's two lines on this chart, and I'm using the US 10-year bond yields on this. So we've sort of come up from sort of 1% growth post-pandemic up to 5%. It touched off before falling pretty rapidly back down to 4%, and it's been lifting a little bit in recent times relative to where we've been. 4%'s at the upper end of where we were over the last decade or so. So from 2010 onwards, there wasn't you basically were below 4% that pretty much that whole time. The other chart I've got on there, and so what that means is, bond yields are relatively high relative to where we've traded in the past. They're certainly lower than say in the 2000s, and so then it's a question of what type of inflation rate environment are we facing? So the other one I've got on there is the inflation adjusted bonds, and just looking at the yields you can get on those, and they're still quite high. So you can still get sort of a 2% yield on that plus inflation, and that's almost 2%, a little bit below 2%, and that's a fair bit higher than what we've seen again for over the last decade, and more similar to what you saw early in the 2000s. And why I'm showing those separately is because what you can do is you can effectively just subtract them and use that as a bit of a proxy for the implied, well, the expected inflation rate over the next 10 years. So this is what markets are pricing. And so pricing in above 2%, so certainly above what we saw in the sort of 2010s to 2020, where we saw inflation pretty consistently 2% or below, and priced as if 2% below. So there still is a reasonable amount of inflation priced in, but much lower than what was being priced in, say, 6 or 12 months ago. If you look through at actual inflation, so I've used it in the US, but this is pretty similar wherever you go around the world, is that what you're seeing is headline inflation rates rocketed into last year, well, into 2 years ago, and then over the last year they've been falling pretty rapidly back down to more normal levels, still above more normal levels, but the question is, will it smooth out? And there's a number of people who have arguments for why inflation rates will stay higher, and then again, the idea of this core inflation rate, which is the inflation rate excluding food and energy, because energy in particular has come off quite sharply over the last year, so driving that down, drove the prices up 2 years ago, but it's come down a lot faster. The other big one for the US, just to keep an eye on, is this idea of that a really large proportion of the US inflation rate is the rents and what's implied, and they do implied rent that goes into that applies to homeowners, whereas in Australia it's done very differently. But so what that means is that rental in the US, rental inflation is a really key measure. So if you look at the sort of the CPI measure, which I've got as a chart on there, showing up as a red line there, that is still running at over 6%. And the reason why it's running at over 6% is because there's a lag within it, in that in terms of the way these are calculated, is that if rents jump, say, this month by 20%, most people are still sitting under some sort of rental agreement, and so everyone's rents doesn't jump by 20%. This one is just new people, and so you need to average it in over time as rental contracts come to an end, and then they jump up in price. So that's the red line. The blue line is the Zillow index for rents, and the green line is the apartment list for rents. So that's running at negative now. And the Zillow's dropped to 3%, and so which is sort of pretty similar to pre-pandemic levels. So yes, I guess it's a question. It's that red line will come down quite markedly over the next 6 to 12 months, basically because it's just creating averages from what's already sort of locked in. So that's sort of, I guess, a technical way of just looking at that inflation and saying, okay, that's that. Certainly in the US, you've almost locked in a big chunk of the index coming in lower every month. Then you go to the I've actually titled this wrong, Leela, sorry, but this is just a look at a global manufacturing index. So these PMIs, I'll talk about a few of them later on. What they are is purchasing manager indexes. So basically they go out and just survey companies and say, are you expecting to put prices up or down, or and expecting to get more orders next month or less orders, and what happened this month, did you get more or less? And so they're a very good sort of forward fast indicator in terms of what's going on. Having said that, they can sort of give you the wrong answer sometimes, and they are just surveys, it's not actual data. So if you look at the manufacturing part of that, so this is what they're asking to manufacturers, and they look at the output prices, And then you basically shift it forward 6 months. That's what this chart is showing at the moment, which is goods inflation versus what the purchasing manager index is saying. And it's pretty, it's a pretty decent correlation between the two, you know, in aggregate. There's certainly, you do get times where the manufacturing index heads one way and then an actual goods inflation is headed the other direction. But in aggregate, it's pretty close. And what that's saying is that, yeah, that's, yeah, you can lock in those lower inflation rates based on that for goods as well from on a global basis. So I guess the thought process behind this is saying, okay, inflation's really important in terms of this valuation. So when we're doing the valuation, yeah, why I was showing these is saying if bond yields keep falling, then you can justify higher prices in equities. If inflation keeps falling, then you can justify higher prices in equities, as long as it's not affecting earnings growth. And we'll move on to that just after this message.
We'll be back with the investment insights very shortly. Nucleus Wealth is an active and passive investment manager. If you like what you're hearing and want some help with your investing, we can do it for you via our active portfolios. Our tactical and core portfolios use the insights shared in this podcast to construct and manage your investment. We blend tactical portfolios to offer our combinations of international shares, Australian shares, government bonds, and cash. We vary the asset allocation with the goal of protecting your capital in times of market uncertainty. We also have active international and Australian share portfolios. These are chosen using our quality and value investment philosophy. You can find out more at nucleuswealth.com. Now back to the show.
Right. The next thing I wanted to jump to was what's actually been working over the last year, just to sort of at least have that as a factor for you to be thinking about. So we've got a number of different screens here. And what I'm showing here is the quarterly returns for a bunch of different factors. And what I mean by fact, and the top part is the US S&P 500, and the bottom part's Europe. And the idea is from this is what I'm really trying to look for is what are the things that have been working in terms of investments over the last 12 months or longer. So we can try and work out, well, is that a trend we're expecting to continue, or are we looking at reversals? And this is what this is saying, what's the market been paying for? And so in the last 12 months, for both of them at the bottom was valuation. So now partly this is because there's a pretty big loading into banks and pretty big loading into energy within these sectors. It's also a little bit of a factor of their measures, but the reality has still been that value stocks have been underperforming, and that's something we're expecting to continue. But it's it has bounced around from quarter to quarter, but that's certainly one area where, you know, we are expecting that as a continued trend. If you look at the quality sort of factors, things like earnings quality, the margins, analyst expectations, they've generally been positive over the last year. And the other thing, you know, very much been noticing, particularly in the US, but across both, is that size has been a real factor. So the large companies have been performing much better than the small companies. Now partly that's the sort of top seven stocks, but there has been, yeah, that's a little bit of that quality factor as well in terms of companies that can hold on, that are bigger, often higher quality, and often have more of a chance to hold on to their margins when things start to get a bit tight. And that's really what we're sort of looking at in terms of factors that we're affecting over the next 12 months, is that quality stocks, ones that have managed to increase their prices and are going to be able to hold on to those price rises as inflation weakens and it gets tougher to put through price rises. If you look at the earnings side, I'm going to jump into this in it's slightly, it's getting slightly technical. So what I've got here is a chart showing the 12-month forward earnings versus the actual earnings. So And the actual earnings is basically the last 12 months. So just a rolling period. So as a company reports its quarterly, say they throw that in, it goes along. So you can see from the actual earnings that actual earnings have been pretty weak. And the slight tick up at the bottom in the last few months, but you sort of call them flat rather than rising. So actual earnings are weak. If you look at the forward earnings though, and particularly over the last year, you've seen this that red line take off, and that's I think for me key to 2024. If that red line keeps rising, then the markets can hold up and off you go. If that red line starts to fall, as we saw in 2022, then that's where markets are going to struggle. And so, you know, getting a feel for that is our key for 2024. It does still look well. I'll run through what else we're seeing within that, and then we can talk about our overall expectations. So I just wanted to highlight how that red line comes about. And so if you look at, I've got a couple of different charts on the screen. One is the 2023. Those are the blue lines are sort of showing the year-by-year numbers. And so 2023, so for anyone listening in, has started and sort of fell about 10% over the time period and then just flattened out. And it really hasn't gone anywhere for a while. 2024 sort of gradually eased down for most of the year, most of the last year. And the red line is showing, so we've got this red line that's showing the 12-month forward numbers. And so the jump in that expectations for forward earnings is because we've got less and less of 2023 and more of 2024. And so at the moment, it's 100% 2024. And then it's going to start getting a little bit of 2025 into that. And there's some quite good growth forecast for 2024 and 2025. If you add the two together, you're looking at 20% plus growth, closer to 25% growth within the US. In the global markets, it's a little lower, but it's still 20% plus growth is forecast for the next 2 years. And so that's the key is where's that coming from? Is that realistic? And if you do start seeing that fall. So in terms of growth rates, I've got a similar chart, just sort of this time just showing the year-by-year growth rates and how that changed. Now, what we've seen there is that the 2023 basically started at a 10% growth rate, fell to zero, and then stayed there for pretty much the rest of the year. And we've got the fourth quarter numbers coming in. It looks like they're going to come in and maybe it'll edge above zero, maybe it'll be back to zero. It's sort of there or thereabouts. Meanwhile, 2024 and 2025 are still some pretty hefty forecasts for in there. So 2024 has been coming back. So it's down to 11% growth now in the US and sort of 8% globally. 2025 is still looking at almost 13. So if you break that down, I've got some charts on the right, left-hand side, I've got the 2023, and the right-hand side, I've got 2024. So we've had these big seven stocks, the Magnificent Seven, Alphabet, Alphabet, which is Google, Facebook, Amazon, Tesla, Nvidia, Microsoft, and I've forgotten one. I've all sort of really driven these, driven most of these, the share price performance for markets, international markets. They've also driven the earnings growth. So in 2023, those stocks, between just those seven stocks alone, added almost 3% to global growth. And then every other stock basically took that all away and you ended up with basically earnings flat for 2023. If you look at 2024, there's expectations that the big seven are basically going to do about the same thing again, but all those other stocks have all turned around, and that's the chart on the right, basically showing that all these other stocks are going to add to it. Is the expectation for 2024? So if you look at what's factored into the fourth quarter, which is just about to start reporting in about 2 weeks' time, is that the fourth quarter is pretty much the same trend as what we saw for the prior year, was 5% growth. Coming out of that big seven tech, and then everything else, detracting, and you end up back at zero. for first quarter earnings, that's starting to go a little bit the other way. It's probably the most optimism is actually in the US, the rest of the US, excluding those big seven. So they're looking at quite a big turnaround in terms of the expectations into Q1. So, and that's really going to be one of the key factors we're going to be watching in that sort of coming up that next 2 weeks is when do we start seeing some what we think is more realism factored into those numbers. But and where that's coming from is my conversations with companies and listening into conference calls and the like is really that what companies are expecting is that they're going to be able to keep putting through some sales prices, but none of their but their costs are going to fade away. So, which on an individual basis might sound all right, is like, you know, we managed to get through 6 or 7% sales increases last year, and maybe this year it might be 4 or 5%. But last year we had 6 or 7% costs increase as well, whereas we're expecting this year the costs might be 1 or 2%. So then we get this nice EPS growth. Now that might be true, but it can't be true for everyone. So there's sort of that cognitive dissonance that if every company, my costs as a company is somebody else's sales. So if my costs aren't rising, for everyone's costs aren't rising, then everyone else's sales can't be rising as well. And that's where I think that's what we're looking for. Now, in a way, that's sort of what happened for 2023, though. And the issue, why do we keep seeing the market perform? Well, we kept seeing the market perform because the downgrades were relatively slight. And also, there was this expectation of a rebound kept on getting pushed out. So basically, the story would be, okay, we had a bad quarter, but actually, so that just means we were expecting a recovery next quarter, and we just had a bad quarter with this one. Well, actually, now we're expecting the following quarter to be better, and so everything just got sort of pushed out as the numbers came down. And so if that keeps happening, then that's sort of a recipe for the stock market, to sort of trade there and thereabouts. Maybe it goes down a little bit, maybe under that scenario, but it might not, the bottom might not fall out. The question is, if you start to get a further expectation of continued weakness, and that's where for companies tend to expect, and human beings generally tend to expect, well, whatever I just saw is whatever I'm going to keep seeing. So if we've just had a rainy day, then I'm probably going to have another rainy day. Or I've just had 5 days of sunshine, I'm probably going to another 5 days of sunshine. And so that's where the earnings side is going to be pretty critical to this, is that trying to work out whether you end up in that, if you get enough bad results that then the future, the forecasts then come down significantly, that's where the danger is for the market. If it's just a little bit sort of drip fed into the, and it can just be keep going along with the, yeah, okay, earnings are bad now, but they're about to get better, then that's a recipe. Yeah, that's a recipe for markets holding up a lot better than if you go to a more of a downturn. I'll go into more detail on some of the economic data after this message.
We'll be back again shortly. If you like what you're hearing but want a low-cost passive option, Nucleus Wealth is the first to offer passive direct indexing in Australia. The first generation of passive investing was index funds. The next gen was ETFs. Now, direct indexing is here with significantly more customization and control. The benefit of direct indexing is you can add or subtract investment themes, and we have almost 100 different options to choose from. For example, you could buy an international share direct index portfolio that excludes fossil fuels and arms manufacturers and has a tilt towards cybersecurity and cloud computing. Alternatively, you could buy a portfolio with no screens and an extra exposure to nuclear power and defense contractors. You can find out more at nucleuswealth.com. Now back to the show.
Right, so that's first we've covered off on valuations and what's happening on the valuation front. Next, had a quick look at earnings and what's happening on the earnings front. Now just wanted to get into economics and having a look at some of the economic indicators that are out there and some of the faster moving ones. So one of the key ones that does help to drive markets is economic surprise. Now, again, this is sort of a little bit self-referential, but it's the idea of, if you've set yourself a low bar, then you can hop over it then, and then markets like that, and then, but sometimes when a high bar has been set, then actually it becomes quite difficult to exceed those. So there's a few different indexes out that track this. Now, I've just got one of them up, which is the Citigroup Economic Surprise Index. And one of the things just highlighted on that graph is that, you know, 2022, we had a lot of negative economic surprise. And 2023, we had a lot of positive economic surprise. So regardless of what the actual levels were, so they might have been the same. You know, you might have been expecting, say, 2% growth in both years. Actually, sorry, I think it's probably the other way around. You probably had 2 or 3% growth sort of factored into 2022. And the fact it came in at lower than that was bad. Stock markets fell, bond yield rose. 2023, we sort of saw the opposite. Growth itself was reasonable, but for a lot of part, it was actually just the fact that it was better than expected. There was a lot of people going into 2023 expecting recessions, and so then when it didn't come out to be, that was, you know, that upgrade to expectations is what helped to drive the markets as much as the growth itself did. So where are we starting from? Well, we're starting from pretty close back to, you know, we're not far above zero, so slightly was, you know, the slightly positive in terms of the economic surprise, but so there's not a lot, I guess, we can gain from that in either direction, but except to note as well that there is a reasonable amount of pendulum effect within this, where you'll get some good numbers come through, and then everyone will be upgrading their earnings and keep upgrading their earnings and keep upgrading until all their forecasts for all these economic indicators until they get too positive, and then they start going in the opposite direction. And so we have been coming down, but yeah, it's not a so this isn't something you sort of use as a forecasting tool, but it's certainly something that's worth noting in terms of the effect it's going to have on the market as you get these surprises or not. Next, I've just got some charts up on some of the trade indicators. Now, the latest stuff is November. So we ran through the trade one last week, just talking about, in a lot more detail, just talking about how there's problems in terms of shipping, both in and around Egypt and in and around the Panama Canal. And so the problems with that, though, we didn't expect to flow through anywhere near as much as what they did during the pandemic, because the problems we had last time when we had a ship stuck was basically the icing on top of the cake, as opposed to the real sort of fundamental underlying reason, and that all the other reasons go in the other direction at the moment. So we should be able to handle it. Having said that, we haven't really got that data out yet, so it's hard to tell. It is worth noting. So, the LA cargo ports, you know, after a pretty terrible 2023, generally was looking pretty good in November. Singapore was looking a little bit better. Hong Kong was looking pretty bad, and the Baltic Dry was pretty neutral in terms of how that was going. If you look at the purchasing manager indexes again I've got the advanced economies here, is that the manufacturing ones tend to be negative, and still they've been negative for all of 2023 and are continuing to be negative. The non-manufacturing are pretty much neutral, and slightly, they were slightly positive coming towards the end of the year, but it's light ball stuff really. So neutral on the services side and positive on the negative on the manufacturing. If you look at industrial production, I've got a bunch of different countries showing, but it's the same trend in all of them. It's been weak on that. So I've got a 20-year odd chart, so it's really just as that last little bit, but every single one of them seems to be weak. I've got four up there: US, Eurozone, Canada, Germany, all showing that same trend. And if you look through four more, so just going through the G7, so to speak, UK also. UK is probably a bit flatter. France probably looks better, probably looks the best out of these. Italy is just that solid downward trend, and Japan's been a bit volatile as well, but certainly on a negative trend. If you jump to small businesses in the US, so 2022 and 2023 were pretty bad overall in terms of optimism. that seems to be improving. It's still negative, but it's certainly the optimism seems to be, well, maybe the other way of saying the pessimism seems to be declining as opposed to optimism. If you look at jobs, that's been the real strength in terms of particularly unemployment rates. So we are starting from a pretty strong position. You know, Eurozone, they're looking at record low unemployment rates, really low in countries like the Netherlands and Germany, kept up by some of the Southern European in terms of your overall numbers. But you know, in aggregate terms, it's unemployment's been quite good. The US is similar, although I just do want to highlight that they have two different surveys, one for households and the other one for businesses. And the business one seems to be ticking along. The household survey has been a bit weaker, particularly of late. And so there's a disconnect, I guess, within the jobs, but that's worth sort of keeping an eye on. And the other thing is earnings and particularly real wages have been pretty poor, you know, ex the US, where it's been all right. A lot of other countries, and Australia in particular, is one of those. But I've got a Japanese chart up there showing the same thing for Japan, is that real wages have been quite deeply negative. So what I mean by that is real wage growth. So the wage growth you're getting minus the inflation rate has been quite negative. And even in a country like Japan that's had quite low inflation relative to the rest of the world, that's been very much the case. And so if that continues, well, the fact it's already come this far, and that's a relatively common indicator to show that the job market might not be as strong as it might look. So that's sort of run through the economic indicators. I wanted to jump to, we have a question come through. If anyone else has got sort of questions as well, feel free to throw them on in the chat. But yeah, question from Jude about, is there less creative destruction in democracies over the past decade? And if so, what are the two or three major impacts for investors? Absolutely. There's been less creative destruction. I would say that's come out of the financial crisis from 2008, where we saw a lot of bailouts and a lot of companies that were, you didn't want the entire world to unwind. I get that, but there wasn't as much consequences as I think many people would have liked for companies that did do the wrong thing. And that extended very much into COVID. So COVID was a much more extreme version of that. And so bankruptcies really fell, and are still sort of already just sort of getting coming back to more normal levels, and you haven't seen a catch up within that. So the idea for that is that's probably a bad thing for overall for productivity, and that might be a reason to explain some of the weaker productivity that you've seen. So the idea behind this is that with creative destruction, you have a company that's actually not doing a very good job. It eventually should eventually go bust, and the workers from that and all the resources from that get put into the companies that are doing a good job, and so the economy sort of rises that way. Whereas if you keep those other companies alive that aren't doing a good job, they just sort of sit there and sort of detract from productivity. So what does that mean for investors? Well, two things. One is we went through this quite extreme scenario over COVID where we basically made sure the companies didn't go broke. And this wasn't just Australia. This is a global phenomenon. And so the question we've got to be nervous about or at least concerned, at least certainly aware of, is that if that reverses and we go into this period where there's a payback now, and the companies, so we had a lot fewer companies go broke over the last few years than average. We're back to average. If we go through a period of above average now to sort of clear out the dead wood, will that actually turn into a bigger downturn than many are expecting? And I would say absolutely yes. If it's like your bushfire, we've built up all this dry tinder, and so therefore when the bushfire does come through, it ends up being worse. Question is though, whether that will be allowed to occur. So that's the the trillion-dollar question, I guess, for the world economy is that will we see at the slightest sign of trouble that central banks step in and just bail everyone out and we go again? And so there's a pretty reasonable chance that happens as well. So, you know, I guess elevated risks, and I guess it's a good sort of way to put that in context of the overall market. So what we're looking at is an overall market that looks not at the most expensive it's ever been, but certainly expensive. It's priced in a lot of growth. So if you get if you do get disappointment on the growth, then you will get and the prices don't move, then you will be at sort of all-time highs in terms of the in terms of pricing. And economic indicators that are not too bad. You know, they're economic surprise is about neutral. We're looking at relatively strong jobs, inflation plummeting. The real question now is how far the pendulum goes. So we're basically seeing the pendulum swing out pretty hard to one side in terms of positive economic surprise and better earnings. Sorry, not better earnings, better jobs than expected. And worse inflation. Now we're seeing the pendulum swing back, and it's sort of getting pretty close to coming through neutral. The question is how far that pendulum will swing out the other way. And that's sort of the real thing to watch in terms of whether we're headed for soft landings and a more constructive investment environment, or whether things will get worse. Another question, through from Peter, I guess following on that, so like creative destruction, is there danger in the strong getting stronger, leading to monopolistic practices? Absolutely, and Australia is the king of that. Lots of oligopolies. The one of the ones that we popped up on Macro Business just yesterday was a question. Some of these thoughts around food prices, and we've seen, the Australian government come out looking at what they can do to try and work on retail food prices. If you look at the food price indexes, the raw commodities, so agricultural prices, they've been plummeting for 18 months to 2 years now. If you look at the UN food price indexes, I think they're largely down 5 to 10% over the last year. And then you look at inflation rates for food. And Australian food inflation is sort of running at over 5%, and the US isn't quite as bad as that, but it's certainly well above its historical levels. It's sort of more like 3%. So whereas food inflation usually is below 2%, that whole monopolistic practices. That's the question about saying does that mean that the strong gets stronger, and that mean they can take advantage in terms of pricing, and from an investment perspective, they're the stocks, partly the stocks that we're looking for. So we're looking for quality stocks that have, managed to increase costs and can keep increasing them. Now, in some cases, that's companies with good products and companies that have got, relatively unique investment propositions and good to their customers. In other times, it's just companies that have a good market structure. And so the Aussie banks might fall into that. Not one we're particularly overweight on, but we spoke about how they're the most expensive in the world. They're sort of 70% more expensive than the average world bank, but they're earning more money, and it might just be because that's the market structure where they've been set up to be allowed to make higher profits than elsewhere, and due to the concentration and the risks and the government of the day or the regulators of the day being close to the banks and wanting to make sure that the banking system stays strong. So net investment view is obviously still relatively cautious, but I think the summary again just of where we sit is valuations high, earnings growth forecasts are high, but actual growth has been quite weak, and looking at the nexus between those is really going to be the key for 2024. With that, thanks for listening in. You can, there's lots of different places you can pick up our the Nucleus information. You can get it from We're on all the different, all the usual podcast providers, Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, Twitter. You can go to nucleuswealth.com/content you can grab all these. And, you know, looking forward to a bright 2024, and we'll see everyone again next week.